Chapter 10 is kind of another history lesson, a recounting of history again. And the events there around Sinai and the golden calf and Israel's transgression. We'll be touching on these events, a retelling of these events as we've seen Moses do in previous chapters and is going to continue to do. And, I found myself even looking into chapter 11, trying to help the people that would have been young people under 20, obviously, back in that time. And they should be able to remember those amazing events that took place. So you've got that group of people, and you've got the other group, what would be the younger people that either were too young to remember or weren't even born yet, were born during the 40 years. So, there's a couple of points, I suppose, or just, that Moses is trying to get through to the people and set them up and remind them how to appreciate God. Lauren was telling me that Grant answered the last question. So, question number one, what is the historical setting of these verses which Moses refers to with the expression at that time? Taylor?
Sure. I think the easy answer for this is Sinai. Maybe the harder part is when it's Sinai. We talked in the last chapter, Sinai is the main setting of chapter 9. There are a couple deviations, but the start of chapter 10 is clearly at Sinai. And this mirrors Exodus 34, verse 1, where the Lord says to Moses, almost the exact same words, cut two tablets of stone like the first ones. Basically make two more tablets, and those will be written on as the second version of the Ten Commandments. The hard part, though, is verse 1 of chapter 10 mentions the ark as well. Come upon the mountain and make yourself an ark of wood. And so that gets a little bit difficult because that's not mentioned in Exodus 34. So there's some chronology issues at play. The ark instructions were first given in Exodus 25, verse 10. So that was before the golden calf, before the apostasy, before the events of Exodus 34 when the tablets were broken. The tablets were then placed in the ark later in Exodus 40, verse 20. Again, verse 1 of chapter 10 says, make the ark, put the tablets in it. That's not done until Exodus 40. And the ark wasn't made until after the tabernacle was even erected. The tablets weren't placed in the ark until after the tabernacle had been consecrated. So you have several events that are bound up in this verse. The point, I don't think, is that this was all said at once. It could have been. We don't know what God said at the extent that second time. But I think the point is that God is giving him instructions. You're going to make these tablets. And then here more information is given that this is going to be the final resting place, if you will, of the tablets. And again, that idea of tablets representing the law and the covenant that Israel was entering into, being broken for the rebellion, the golden calf being made again, and then the covenant, those tablets would be enshrined in the ark, which would be in the temple, the spiritual hub of Israel. So there's a lot of symbolism there as well as to what that meant, to make that ark, put the tablets in it, and consecrate, set aside all these spiritual things, and remember that going forward is the point of Exodus 10:1.
Good, thank you. I also found it interesting the phrase that Shahay is referencing at that time. I did a little word searching, and it looks like that phrase, the best I could tell, was used 77 times, used 13 times just in the book of Deuteronomy from chapter 1, verse 16 to chapter 9, verse 19. That phrase is used 6 times in chapter 3. And let's see. Not sure whether I appreciate referencing Exodus 25:16, Exodus 34, Exodus 40, all of those events laying the time when they were actually happening back in the book of Exodus. Moses commanded here, and I think it's something that Moses is reminding the people that Moses was commanded to make an ark, and I need to save this for the next question. Keep from bleeding into other questions. Anything else on question number one from anyone? All right, let's look at question number two. That'd be verses 1-5. What did the tablets of stone and the ark have to do with the events Moses has been describing? Lauren?
I think the emphasis is God's willingness to forgive. So Israel broke the covenant on Sinai with the golden calf. Moses, likewise, in anger and in anguish, broke the tablets. So God was willing to renew the covenant, writing on a new set of stones, if Moses was willing to keep them safe in an ark. And Israel had to keep the contents of the covenant. And to the previous statement about the ark, yes, just it says here that Moses was commanded to make this ark. In Exodus 37, it says that Bezalel made the Ark of the Covenant. So I like the explanation that this was a temporary ark that Moses made to house the new tablets of stone until the permanent Ark of the Covenant was made.
Yeah, me too. Anyone else? I didn't appreciate the debate over the different arcs, possibility of two different arcs being barked.
Well, another possibility is that, and it's certainly a provisional ark is certainly a possibility, but I read some on this that said that the Hebrew is not, you know, in English, we sometimes get meanings once it's been translated that aren't there. And some say that the Hebrew word made is qual, perfect tense, and it does not say when the ark was made. And one of the commentators made the point that Moses may simply be referring in a non-time specific that he had the ark made by Bezalel and that housed the covenants. And perhaps the reason it's mentioned, so the question would be then, obviously, well, why is the ark mentioned at this time? Because if he's not specifically making it now, if he's just referring to the fact that it was made by his commandment, Moses' commandment that it be made, and at a different time, why is it mentioned? And perhaps there's a thematic reason that the Ark of the Covenant is mentioned here with the tablets of testimony, and that's because the 10 words are the covenant, and the Ark is the Ark of the Covenant. And so Moses is interweaving these two principal signs of the covenant together, and as was pointed out, this is about forgiveness. Moses is, the emphasis here is, despite the fact that you sinned and did terrible pagan idolatrous acts at the base of Mount Sinai and deserved to be wiped away, God renewed the covenant, which you had just broken. And these two symbols of the covenant are primary in this discussion. So I don't think we have to necessarily cleave to the fact that Moses is making an ark, although that's possible. I'm not saying that didn't happen, but it may just also be a thematic idea that Moses is saying, God showed you by these two tablets, he had me make them again. I had to make the tablets, and we had to make the ark. And God, through these items, is showing that he loves you and that he still wants to have a covenant with you.
Yeah, and the two elements aren't the two tablets. It's the tablets and the ark.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Anyone else? Yeah, the focus being, and again, I think it's important for us to keep remembering that Moses is telling all of Israel these things. And this is for their benefit. Moses is trying to explain and point the people back to the Lord and how merciful the Lord is, accepting them back, giving them another chance when, as Bart pointed out, could have easily wiped them and wanted to. Had it not been, we'll see in a little bit here, Moses intervening for the people. Anyone else on question number two? All right, let's look at the third question. How do these parenthetical verses fit with the topic under consideration by Moses? Malin?
Yeah. I think it kind of considers, along the same lines as you were just saying, you know, Moses reminding them of what God did, you know, when Aaron died, and his son Eleazar became the next priest there, and it showed that Aaron was forgiven. And then, you know, in verse 8, talks about the Levites, you know, saying that they were separated as the priesthood, and they were to bear the Ark of the Covenant. And of course, they didn't have the physical inheritance, but their inheritance was of the Lord, just as God promised there.
That's right. Anyone else? Again, we see that phrase, at this time, being used again here in verse 8, I believe it is.
Yeah.
In verse 8. Warren, you look like you were, yeah.
Well, I mean, this kind of fits into what Mark was talking about with the looking forward in time, because Aaron didn't die for many years later after this golden calf incident. You see it almost 40 years later in Numbers 20. So it emphasizes God's forgiveness over a long period of time. At that very point in chapter 9, verse 20, it said that the Lord wished to destroy Aaron.
Yeah, I think that'll be one of the next questions. Yeah, Taylor.
All this is given as a blessing to Israel. The Ten Commandments given again, the Ark to encapsulate that, the priesthood. And then, as has been said, not just the high priest, the Levites as well. All of this, you think of the Ten Commandments and even the Ark as more of a physical, spiritual blessing. In this case, you had an ongoing, a living spiritual blessing in these people. And then the priests in particular were those who were to bless Israel. In Exodus 6, 22 and 27, Moses talks about the blessing. And he says in verse 23 of number 6, speak to Aaron and his son, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace, so that you can put my name on the children of Israel and I will bless them. So all of this is given as a blessing. It works together, this whole bevy of spiritual blessings, to not only provide for the people spiritually going forward, but to remind them, in the case of the Ten Commandments and the Ark, and even the priesthood itself, to stay within this covenant. This covenant that's already been broken once, it's bound up in the Ark, to take it seriously and abide within it.
Yeah, yeah. To get to this time period had been broken by Israel many times. You know, the event there at Mount Sinai, certainly. Bart, you look like it.
Yeah, and let's just remember what Levi did, the tribe of Levi did at this time, to be able to be the tribe that carried the Ark with the symbol of God's covenant. Moses said, who is on the Lord's side, come to me. And the Levites came to Moses' side, and then God gave a very difficult command, which was, put on your swords and go from tent to tent and kill your brethren who have sinned against the Lord. I mean, imagine that. Those are people to know, and what a terrible thing that was. I think implicit in this idea that Taylor mentioned, that they were number six, they were given a blessing to give to people. They were a blessing when they did that. When they went to Moses' side, and then they went out into the camp, and they killed 3,000 people. That was a blessing. You know, from a human perspective, it's like, what a terrible, terrible thing. But they fulfilled God's command, and they prevented the wrath of God from destroying the people utterly. And that applies to us, too. We have the same responsibility in the church when it comes to discipline, church discipline. It doesn't seem like a blessing when we undergo church discipline and we see it happen. But it is a blessing because God has told us to do it, and he is much wiser than us.
Yeah, very good point. Appreciate you bringing that out. Anyone else? You know, this idea of the tablets and the Ark. I mean, I like the visual. I like the way I think that would, again, as Bart pointed out, imagine the tribe of Levi and their role in taking care of the tabernacle and these emblems. You know, we have, you know, we oftentimes refer to the cup and the fruit of the vine as the cup of blessing. And these are emblems for us to, you know, the loaf, and, you know, all those things are reminders for us. They're blessings for us as well. Anything else? All right, question number four. What does the statement, "The Lord also heard me," imply about the prayers of the faithful? Landon?
So simply, this means if you're faithful or if you keep the covenants, when you pray, God will hear you. And I think a good verse for this is 1 John 5, verse 14 through 15. Now this is the confidence that we have in him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us. And if we know that he hears us, whatever we ask, we know that we have the petitions that we have asked of him.
Yeah, very good. Good verse. I was thinking of James 5 and verse 16. The effectual, perfect prayer of a righteous man avails much. And there's other passages. Anyone else? All right. Acts chapter 10, verse 31, the fervent prayer of Cornelius, not yet a Christian, was effective, wasn't it? The Lord heard his prayer as well. Taylor.
To say something in this verse, we talked in the past about the different types with Moses, and I'm sure this came up during the Exodus study that was here, but here Moses is acting as a mediator for the people. Later on, the high priest is supposed to make intercession for the people. And in this case, the high priest needed someone to make intercession for him. And so Moses is taking over that role as mediator for the people, and that's obviously a direct tie to Christ and his role for us today in this kind of.
Yep, that's right. Very good. Yeah, these two verses here are very similar to what Moses had just said in chapter 9, verses 18, verse 19, verse 25. Very similar words. A writer that I read from, speaking about verse 11, wrote, "God wants us to move on with him, and when we are walking right with God again, we will go in and possess the land." So the idea of getting right with the Lord, and the Lord wants us to be faithful to him. Any other comments on question number four? All right, question number five. What is the difference between heaven and the highest heavens? Levi?
The first heaven is the Earth's atmosphere. The second heaven was space. And the third is the dwelling place of God.
I think you're exactly right, as best I could tell. Anyone else have anything they want to say about question number five? And or these verses, verses 12 through 15? Wes?
I agree with Levi. I can just give a little bit of context to support exactly what he said. In Genesis 1:1, we have the heavens. That's the atmosphere around the earth. We know that because when the flood started in Genesis 7, it says the windows of heaven were opened. And it says all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. So it's referring to the sky, what we see. That's the first heaven. The second heaven, we see a few examples in Exodus 32. Verse 13 refers to the stars of heaven. So now we're not talking about our own earthly atmosphere, but the outer space, as Levi said, the celestial atmosphere. We see that also in Nehemiah 9 and verse 6. It says, "You alone are the Lord, you made heaven, the heaven of heavens." Same thing we see here. And it says, "with all their hosts." The host means the planets and the stars. And so we know that heaven of heavens there means the atmosphere beyond our atmosphere, our heaven's heaven. And then the third heaven is a really interesting thing. I did some reading up on this. It's mentioned by Paul in the New Testament, 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 2. Paul describes a vision of paradise. He says, I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. In verse 4, that same chapter, the same word translated third heaven appeared as paradise, capital P. And in the Septuagint, the standard Greek translation of the Old Testament, that same word translated paradise is used for the Garden of Eden. So not probably literally the Garden of Eden, but a magnificent garden, a beautiful place of some kind. And then to tie it all together, in Revelation 4:2, it tells us that God's throne is in heaven. We know this isn't the first heaven, because that would mean we could see God in the sky. We know it's not the second heaven, because God would be observable in outer space. And so the third heaven described by Paul, this paradise, we could assume that that is the throne of God. It's where God dwells. And the third heaven could be the heaven of the heaven of the heaven.
Yeah, I read, Kaufman pointed out that the original Hebrew of verse 14 had heaven listed three times. Each time was plural. And the idea, his suggestion was that Moses was trying to impress upon Israel again the power of God. Anyone, Taylor?
This exact same phrase, as I can tell, is used in 1 Kings 8:27 as well for another reference. But I think the point within verse 14 is just all that may be called heaven, everything. And in verse 14, he says the earth as well. The point is heaven, highest heavens, earth, all belong to the Lord and God. Every created thing, everything that's always been, it's always belonged to God. But I think it's really important as well to note that verse 12 is a very big shift within this chapter, because now we're going from this recounting of history that we've done for several chapters now. I'm sort of going back and forth, but now we're shifting into present exhortation, which I think is going to continue for quite a while. And so this is a big shift within this chapter. We've gone over the history, and then this is maybe the climax of the history at the end of chapter 9, beginning of 10, at Sinai, and everything that went down there. And now we're moving, using that as exhortation, now moving to present exhortation by Moses. And I thought verses 12 and 13 are really powerful, just the things that God requires of his people: fear, love, obedience to the law, keeping the commandments. And then that fear is interesting to read about a little bit. It's not the, a fear in the sense of fear of the dark, or the fear that's described in 1 John 4:18 is perfect love, something that it casts out. And the fear that's mentioned here is referring to reverence to God, awe, respect for God. But it's really neat that the law is essentially borne out in just those two verses, those different things. If you do this, if you follow the commandments, love the Lord, similar to what Jesus said in the New Testament, the focal points of the law, keeping those things, and then everything else is bound up within that. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I really appreciate you bringing up verse 12, because it is, there's a transition here. That's a good point. Lauren, you acted like you were going to add something.
Yeah. Taylor brought up verse 12. There is a similar reference to that in Micah 6:8, where it says, What does the Lord require of you but to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God? Here in Deuteronomy, we see that his command is to love God, to fear him, and to do his commandments. And Micah ties in the mercy and love of fellow man with it. So, you know, it's similar to what you see in John 4:24, to worship God in spirit and truth, to do it correctly and with the correct state of mind.
Yeah. And thinking about verse 12 as it moves into verse 13, and to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command you today for your good. For your good. I mean, and that's what the Lord's will is for us. It's for our own good. I think it's something we need to keep in mind. It'll make us better people able to help and serve others. Anything else? All right, question number 6. How did Moses use circumcision in verse 16? What is said about God in the final section of this chapter, Mark?
Well, Moses is summing up the idea of the covenant here. The theme of, I think, of this chapter has been the covenant. And the sign of the Abrahamic covenant was circumcision, a physical circumcision. And so he uses this metaphor to show them the true meaning, which is presages the New Testament. And he wants them not to just focus on that physical sign of circumcision, which still had to be done, but more importantly, to circumcise their hearts and not to be stiff-necked. And of course, that is the great challenge of all servants of God, is that we are to cast away our inclination, our corrupt affections, and the things that pull us away from God and hinder us, and to remove the lust of the flesh from our life the best we can and follow after God. Remove the filthiness of our hearts. and love God. And so we're not to trust, the Jews were not to trust in the circumcision of the body, but to be circumcised in heart. And of course, the verse in Romans, I thought of, that Paul writes in Romans 2:29 is, he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God, where they make sure that we circumcise our hearts and cast away sin from us. And also, it's interesting, just a side point, Shahay has, with great clarity, pointed out to us that the sign of the covenant, of the Abrahamic covenant was, and the Mosaic covenant, rather, the Mosaic covenant was the circumcision, and the sign of the covenant of the New Testament is the cup. The cup is the new covenant in my blood, Luke 22, verse 20. So part of the new covenant is the sign, which is a single cup. People rejected under Abraham rejected circumcision, but under the new covenant, they reject the single cup. So I thought that was interesting. As far as the last part of the question, what is said about God in the final section, I think it's been well covered by comments in just the last couple minutes. I just love these verses. God is much criticized by people today, but he administers justice for the fatherless and the widow. He loves the stranger. Our culture is not about loving the stranger here in the 21st century, but God loves the stranger. He gives him food and clothing, and the implication is that that is what we're to do. We're to love the stranger. We're to love the fatherless and the widows. We're to visit orphans and widows in their distress. And verses like this are just, they're so encouraging because it shows us the face of God, which we see in Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, verse 22, reminding Israel that the Lord had taken 70 of their descendants and grew them into a nation over 400 years, despite being in captivity as slaves, grew them into this humongous, this innumerable nation of people. Taylor?
One thing I thought of when Bart was talking, I hadn't really thought of before. I might be exposing my ignorance a little bit here, but it seems like this is one of the few places in the Old Testament where circumcision in verse 16 is given as sort of a spiritual aspect, circumcising the heart within the Old Testament. Maybe it's mentioned more, but it seems like, at least, that it's used more as a spiritual aspect in the New Testament. Presbyter Paul goes back over and over and over to it. And it's interesting to think about the Jews in this day and then into the New Testament were so good, in a sense, at that physical circumcision. They had that done to the point that was an issue in the church, even after it was said, you know, this is no longer bound. That was such a sticking point for the Jews, but yet that spiritual aspect was lost. It was lost back then, and it was lost in the New Testament as well. That's why I appreciate Bart reading that verse in Romans 2, because that was the whole point. Everything that's bound up in that, the act itself, even under the old law, there was nothing saving about that act within the covenant. It was required, but that spiritual type and then what it means to us today is what's so important. It's something that Israel failed to see over and over.
Yeah, that's right. Very good. Anyone? What?
It's easy to think of the New Testament and the New Covenant as getting us out of having to follow these rules and rituals, in a sense. And that focusing more on the spiritual side versus following these rules opens us up and makes it where we don't have to live in the Old Testament life. And you think about Jesus talking about Phariseeism and people blindly following these rules and not having the spiritual component. You think about Jesus and the apostles preaching this new, what is presented as a new way of loving God. But this shows that it was there all along, that even back in Deuteronomy in Moses' time, Moses was saying, you need to have the spiritual side as well. It wasn't just follow these rules and you'll make it to the promised land. It was you also have to love God.